Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. On Christmas Day, 1832, Joseph Smith received a Civil War prophecy. It's section 87 in our Doctrine and Covenants. 30 years later, the Civil War began. William Bickerton was so impressed with this prophecy, and he thought it was the end of the world, literally. In our next conversation with Dr. Daniel Stone, we'll talk about William Bickerton's beliefs about this Civil War prophecy and how it eventually led to black ordination in their church. It's a pretty interesting conversation, and I hope you check it out. Hey, everybody, I just wanted to mention one other thing. My cameraman here is here. This is our 200th episode. This is Preston Bennett, and so he wanted to just say a quick word here.
So I've been glad to help my dad with these podcast videos.
Yes, and he's been very helpful, so I really appreciate that. So anyway, in celebration of our 200th episode, Preston thought he would like to come join us. So thanks a lot, Preston. Appreciate your help. Now back to our conversation. We're into the, I believe, 1860s now. Mm-hmm. What are kind of the next big things that happen within the Bickertonite movement?
Okay. One really thing that's a big emphasis in the William Bickerton biography, and it's going to drive the rest of William Bickerton's life, is the idea of the Civil War being the cataclysmic destruction that was going to usher in the millennium. From once that Civil War actually begins, William Bickerton is gung-ho about Joseph Smith's Civil War prophecy. And this is where you start to, like we said earlier, seeing him ordain the Quorum of 12 Apostles. That happens in 1862, right in the middle of the Civil War. Prophecies and revelations that are coming out in the church at this time. And mind you, it's not only William Bickerton, he's prophesying a lot, but several others are prophesying, men and women. And
if you, within the Bickertonite movement,
you see the back and forth of the prophecies, the tongues, the interpretation of tongues, and all of these are kind of, many of them are talking about what's going on in the country. And you see it's talking about a peaceful onset, what the church needs to do to kind of bring about. And one of the big things that is happening from the beginning of the Civil War is this idea that they need to go to the Native Americans. They need to go preach to them because William Bickerton believes that this choiceer, this named Joseph, is going to rise up out of the American Indians, is going to kind of be like the American Indian Moses, in a sense, and kind of gather his people and help build the New Jerusalem. They actually believe that the Native Americans are going to kind of lead the way and that their job is to preach this gospel to them. So after the Civil War, during the Civil
War... A new Samuel the Lamanite.
Exactly, exactly. Okay. So as the Civil War is going on, you see the church really starts to grow. Over 200 people within a matter of just one missionary trip join. So you see it's really growing pretty quickly for a small little movement like this. They're eventually going into Ohio, they're going into Virginia, and they're really spreading out more and more.
Now, since you mentioned Ohio, are we talking Kirtland, where we've got some Mormon settlements, or are they just preaching to just any so-called Gentiles?
That's interesting. One woman that was from the Kirtland era eventually joins the Bickertonite movement. And she actually says that she received some type of blessing. It might even have been a patriarchal blessing. I'd have to look. When she was prayed on, they had promised her that she would live to see Zion flourish. And when she saw all this happening under the Bickertonite movement, she says, "Now I've seen that prophecy come true." So you see, and there was another person that during this time of the Civil War, or right around that time, you see this person is traveling to Nauvoo, or trying to get to Nauvoo, and they said that they kind of got lost, and for several nights they heard singing in the air, and they tried to follow the singing. And of course, this is William Bickerton's account, and he said that this person every night was hearing singing, and eventually that person was led by the singing right to William Bickerton's front door, he said.
Oh, wow.
And that person. So William Bickerton's really believing during the Civil War, this is when people are going to start joining the church. They write this missionary tract called The Ensign. Because of what Isaiah says, I'm going to raise an ensign on the mountains. Where are they? They're right in the foothills of the Allegheny Mountains, right? So the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Utah are looking among themselves among the Wasatch Mountains, right? And they're the ensign. You know, the LDS magazine even now is called the Ensign. Mm-hmm. Well, William Bickerton, their first missionary tract is called the Ensign. And then it's got this really long title after, like, A Light to Lighten the Gentiles, you know, a description of the prophecy of the latter days, such and such and such. But in the end, they're trying to use this as a missionary tract, and they address it to all the honorable elect. And I forget how it goes. It's in the book, but it basically it's addressed to all kings and potentates and the president of the United States and all Congress and officials. So they're really seeing this as a worldwide movement, and they're trying to get it going, and the church
so
is really growing.
So they're not just simply targeting Mormons or Community of Christ or anything like that. They're just anybody.
Well, eventually they're going to try to target members of the Latter-day Saint movement, and that's going to be right after the Civil War, too. So there's kind of this weird, during the Civil War, there's kind of this battle within the Bickertonite Church, this battle of ideas where what's more important, preaching to the Americans or the general Americans or preaching to the Native Americans? And you're starting to see the struggle among some of the membership because I think what William Bickerton seems to be having, because he's one of the writers of the Ensign and a few others, but this idea that it needs to go out into all the world with an emphasis on the Native Americans, where some people are like, no, we just need to focus on America first because, you know, there's people that need to be converted because they're going to be destroyed. So the church is really growing at this point. They're not going out to the Native Americans because of the Civil War, but they're doing major missionary efforts. A few of them even go into Virginia as the Civil War is going on. So they're actually entering the Confederacy.
Oh, wow.
And remember, they had members.
Forget, they're a bunch of Yankees.
Yeah, they're right on the edge. So you think about Pittsburgh, and you think where West Virginia is, because West Virginia eventually breaks away. But in the beginning of the war, that wasn't the case necessarily. There was still a lot of there was still part of the Confederacy. So in Wheeling, they have a branch there. And as the Civil War is just, as Virginia basically secedes from the Union, they're having a conference. And there's this beautiful moment where, you know, Lincoln talks about in his first inaugural address, talking about, like, you know, we need to have peace. We need to, you know, cross the borders and find common ground and keep the Union together. And as this is happening, the Bickertonites are having a conference, and some of the members from Wheeling come to Pennsylvania, and they have this moment where they actually wash the feet of the people from Wheeling to show that, you know, even though the war is about to come on and the nation is splitting apart and the South is seceding from the Union, they're trying to show unity and saying, we love you. You are still a member of our church.
Oh, wow.
So the washing of feet is really important within Bickerton's movement as well. It's a humbling moment to show unity and love, just like Jesus did. So that was really a touching moment where you see. And eventually the Civil War, we all know what happens. The Civil War ends up, you know, ending. The Union does win. And the war doesn't reach the whole earth like it was supposed to. So William Bickerton is starting, but he still has this moment where he still believes that that will happen. And he's constantly talking about it. And this is after the war. This is where they're now free, you know, from the calamities that are happening around them, to now go out into to go to the Native Americans. And this is where you see a major push among the Bickertonites: go preach to the Native Americans.
Now, is he disillusioned at all because it was only half fulfilled, or?
Some people seem to be disillusioned. There's a few things that happen after the Civil War that really start to see some battling of the minds within the Bickertonite movement. In 1871, their church headquarters, where in 1859, William Bickerton has this prophecy that angels will guard this house and guard this people, and I'm paraphrasing the revelation, but it basically says that. Well, there's a hotel next to or near their church headquarters in Green Oak, Pennsylvania, and the hotel catches fire, and so does the Green Oak headquarters, and it burns down to the ground. And there's several people are like, wait a minute, you had a prophecy several years ago that said that this house would be protected, and now it's burned down to the ground. That's a false prophecy. Are you a fallen prophet?
Oh, my.
Yeah, and William Bickerton believes, no, it's not the house, like, necessarily. It's the people, you know. It's the house of God. It's metaphorical, and it's symbolic. And they're like, no, you know. And then after the war, too, you start to see major people, you see one apostle and one evangelist even end up leaving the church right after the war. And it's because they don't believe in the Book of Mormon anymore, or so they say. And you see revelations that are saying, like, you need to believe in the Book of Mormon. And they eventually get rid of these people after they're having this revelation. So the idea is, well, these people obviously aren't holding true to the Book of Mormon. And this is right after the war. So you see William Bickerton is very much connecting the scriptures and interpreting, like, chapter, I believe it's chapter 18 in Isaiah, talking about, he believes that it's the scattering and peeling, what Isaiah talks about. He believes that's talking about the United States. And he's talking about the Book of Mormon in 3 Nephi, where Jesus is talking about, I'm going to just throw down your strongholds, I'm going to throw down your cities, and we're going to, you know, they all see this as the Civil War. When the Civil War ends, you see some of the members of the Bickertonite movement going, maybe we believed it, but now the war's over. So William Bickerton is always trying to get to the Native Americans, but it takes him quite a while. They won't get out west until around 1874, 1875. And the war ends in 1865, so it takes about a decade for William Bickerton to finally get to the Native Americans because of all these struggles that they're having within the Bickertonite movement. So there's even dissension within his own group, and William Bickerton is going to have to deal with that till the very day he dies, which makes the story all the more dramatic. But it kind of shows the beauty and the power of having a democratic, egalitarian church where people can prophesy and have a movement, you know, and even vote in, because the presidency is voted in, technically. The apostles are ordained for life, but the presidency, even William Bickerton, even though he's ordained a prophet of the church in 1859, as president of the church, that's an elected office. That is, you know, holy, you know, they put oil on their heads and ordain, and, you know, kind of ordain it or anoint it, but it's still elected. Because William Bickerton, it seems to believe that, he really believes Jesus Christ is returning. He's a millenarian prophet, or what they call a premillennialist. They believe the destruction is supposed to come, and, you know, that's going to help usher in the second coming of Jesus Christ, who's then going to usher in this peaceful onset. He's really unique within American history, because in American history, most Christians are looking at the Civil War, they call it a post-millennialist catastrophe, where, yeah, God is chastening the nation because of slavery. That's one of the reasons. William Bickerton believes that too. But once the war is over, we're going to kind of create this Republican utopian society, and then we're going to kind of create the millennium ourselves through the help of God. And then at the end of the millennium, Jesus Christ will return. Well, William Bickerton's like, no, this is the major destruction, and then Jesus Christ has to come to usher in the millennium. So he's really unique. He's very similar to Brigham Young, because Brigham Young believes that as well, under very similar terms. But we have to understand, William Bickerton and Brigham Young are very, very dissimilar from most other Christians during the American Civil War.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's really, really paramount that we highlight that.
Because I do know that Brigham Young was convinced that the Civil War was basically because they kicked the Mormons out of Nauvoo.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, exactly.
The destruction of the nation.
Exactly. And William Bickerton believes the same thing. He believes it has to do with the sins of the nation, one of them being slavery. William Bickerton, from very early on, he always believed African Americans were equal to whites, especially because of the gospel. He never barred them from holding priesthood offices from the very get-go.
And as I understand, I believe John Hamer has said that the Bickertonite movement had a black apostle in the early 1900s.
Yep.
Which I think is just amazing.
Yeah, they were the first Latter-day Saint group to ever have a black apostle.
That's cool.
And that comes from Bickerton. So what's interesting, so kind of to show the more dissension that's happening after the Civil War, I believe it's in 1871, the Little Redstone branch it's called the racist doctrine. You know, like,
oh, really?
Yeah, the Little Redstone, or that's how I talk about it in the book, the Little Redstone branch in Pennsylvania doesn't want to give equal partnership and equal rights to African Americans, and they believe that black people are below white people.
Is this part of the Confederacy or the Yankees?
This is part of the Yankees.
Oh, really?
So yeah, oh yeah, because okay. Most of America was racist from our standard terms.
Definitely.
You know, the South believed in slavery, and even a lot of people in the North didn't necessarily believe in slavery, but they definitely, most people in the North didn't believe that Africans were equal to whites. And you start to see that even within the Bickertonite movement, there are members that don't believe that African Americans are equal to white people or to the average Americans. And even after the war, you know, African Americans, at least African American men, are given equal citizenship rights to white men. And there's people in the congregation, that little redstone congregation, that don't agree with that, especially within the church. They're going to be barred from the priesthood and all these other things.
Now, is this in Pennsylvania?
This is in Pennsylvania. Okay. So this is Union country after mm-hmm. the war. Mm-hmm. So what ends up happening is one of the conferences, William Bickerton actually, and somebody else, one of the apostles, it was Joseph Aston, I believe, have to write a letter and send it to Little Redstone and tell them. And I really like this letter because it's very politically minded. And they use the scriptures to kind of show, to kind of ease them in, to show them. So they say, listen, in the New Testament, we read that the Gentiles were looked down upon by the Jews. They were considered unclean. But then the Apostle Peter has that dream where God tells them, don't consider the Gentiles unclean anymore. The gospel brings them up. It says, so too have we been taught, or we've been led, I think the term is to use. We've been led to believe or to think that black people, I think they use the term Negro, or colored people. It's colored, I believe they use. We've been led to believe that the colored people are below us, but the gospel brings them up and brings them to have equal access with the supper of the Lord or something like that. Very political, very, very well read, but trying to say, no, they're equal to us. And even if you don't think that they are secularly, the gospel brings them up. Oh, so nice. We are to give them equal access to everything that we have, and they are to be considered everything that we have.
That's cool.
Yeah, so
that's probably pretty ahead of the time.
Culture. Oh, very much so. William Bickerton was very progressive.
Wow.
Believing that the Native Americans are still considered savages, right? They're constantly being brought further and further into reservations. And he's saying, no, these are going to be the people that are going to lead us to Zion, lead us to the millennium. He believes African Americans have equal rights to whites, and they're equal in the eyes of God and within society. And he believes women can be part of the ministry. So
see, now this is really cool that you say this, and here's why I say. I just recently had an online conversation with actually a black LDS member, and I was pretty surprised. He had said he had had a spiritual experience in which he was basically told that the LDS church wouldn't have survived because he was trying to pin it all on God. If God had allowed blacks to hold the priesthood. And I was just like, it was so hard because you're like, I don't want to step on your spiritual experience here.
Mm-hmm.
But I just said, the history doesn't seem to back that up. And because one of the things that I've always liked to point out, the Community of Christ has never had a ban. The Bickertonite Church has never had a ban. And you guys are still around.
Oh, yeah.
And so, I mean, could you comment on that? And I know you're not LDS, but could you, I mean, what do you think of the reasoning when somebody says, yeah, the LDS church just couldn't have survived? And I'm like, well, polygamy was a lot bigger deal than, I mean, the government tried to shut the church down over polygamy. They never tried to do that with race issues.
Yeah.
And so I just have a hard time with anybody who says, yeah, the church wouldn't have survived if we'd have started ordaining blacks.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Well, first off, I'll be the spiritual diplomat, which you're being right now too, and I'm going to kind of go along those same terms, and then I'll talk about what I've been studying for my PhD. For all traditions, we always try to come up with some spiritual reason to kind of equate to why we do something, right? You know, mm-hmm. and if it might not be exactly the way we think, or it doesn't necessarily fall in line with our line of thinking with the scripture, we often say, well, you know, this is how God wants it, or maybe we're not inspired to do it at that moment. You know, we could make those arguments for a lot of things. So I think all a lot of Christianity, but really mostly within the Latter-day Saint movement, especially within the LDS Church and within my tradition, we're very similar in that respect. We very much look to God for revelation to kind of, even though we might think something's right, we wait for God or our leaders to tell us to go that way, for that inspired direction, and we're often okay with waiting until that happens. When I looked at it through my studies, especially Lester Bush, he seemed to be the one that really popped the cork on this one, that it really was a policy. When I read it and when I study the history objectively, it looks like that was more or less a policy under the LDS Church rather than a revelation. And I think the LDS Church is starting to grapple with that even now. So we'll have to see what happens in the future if the general authorities ever come to that terms. It seems like they're kind of leaning towards that. You see, at least maybe not publicly, but at least you kind of read in the scholarship privately. Greg Prince's book about Leonard Arrington kind of goes into that a little bit, and when that change does happen in the 70s. And it's really, from an outsider and from somebody who studies American religion and Mormonism, crazy interesting. You know, it's really interesting to see how they balance that, because it's really interesting to have constant living prophets.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Daniel Stone. In our next conversation, we'll talk about the idea of this question: can a prophet make a mistake in revelation? Dr. Daniel Stone answers that question in the Bickertonite Church, and I think it's a pretty interesting answer.
If there's a revelation, it needs, like a major revelation, that's going to lead the church forward. It's actually supposed to go to conference or to a committee, and people are going to vote on it, whether they agree with it or disagree with it. So it kind of puts some checks and balances on the prophet and his revelation. So very early on, his people, including him, can even recognize that men can make mistakes. Even though they're considered a prophet of God, it is possible that a prophet can false prophesy.
Wow. I hope you enjoyed that short clip from our next interview. If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please go to our patreon.com/gospeltangents and subscribe for just $5 a month. If you'd like a transcript of this, please click the yellow subscribe button at gospeltangents.com, and I'll send you this and all future transcripts. Also, if you'd like a paperback like we've got here, those are available at our website at amazon.com. Just do a search for Gospel Tangents. Please get all updates at our Facebook page at facebook.com/gospeltangents. We're also on Twitter at Gospel Tangents. You can also get transcripts individually at our website, gospeltangents.com/shop. Finally, make sure that you subscribe on our Apple Podcast page. Just do a quick search for Gospel Tangents there and give us a 5-star review while you're at it. Thanks again for listening. Your support helps create more Mormon history classes and podcasts such as this, and so I really appreciate you listening. Please share with your friends. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some more of our great videos. Thanks again.